This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a discussion with Major General Brian Winsky. I'm your host, Rob Habers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago, and is presented with support from members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at pritzkermilitary.org. Today's conversation is with the United States Army's 101st Airborne Division Commander, Major General Brian Winsky. The 101st Airborne Division Air Assault provides our nation with unmatched expeditionary air assault capabilities to conduct forcible entry and other worldwide unified land operations in support of combatant commanders. The 101st plans, coordinates, and executes air assault operations capable of seizing key terrain in support of operational objectives. Also capable of working in austere environments with limited or degraded infrastructure, these operations are typically conducted by highly mobile teams covering extensive distances and engaging enemy forces behind enemy lines. Major General Winsky has proudly served in the 101st Airborne Division Air Assault for over 12 years. His most recent assignment was the Chief Legislative Liaison in the Office of the Secretary of the Army. His other assignments also include service with the 82nd Airborne Division, the 3rd Infantry Division, the 1st Cavalry Division, the Joint Readiness Training Center, and the Army Legislative Liaison Office. Major General Winsky was commissioned through ROTC and entered active duty as an infantry officer. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree in history from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a master's degree from Louisiana State University. His military education includes the United States Army Command and General Staff College, the Joint and Combined Warfighting School, and an Army War College Fellowship with the Washington Institute of Near East Policy. Major General Winsky's military awards include the Distinguished Service Medal, the Legion of Merit, the Bronze Star Medal for Valor, among many others. Please join me in welcoming Major General Brian Winsky to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. General, it is a very great pleasure to have you with us today. I'd like to first ask you about this wonderful new uniform you are wearing today.
So this is going to be the new Army service uniform. It's really the World War II officer service uniform. General Milley decided to adopt this about last year, and we're starting to phase it in, and we'll phase it in over the course of the next couple of years. But it is, as I said, largely the World War II uniform, and it invokes homage to the greatest generation, and kind of intent is to inspire future generations.
So. It certainly does. A great nod to history and a nod to the present and to the future.
Right.
We just had here in Chicago the Air and Water Show, a great event, I think 60-odd years in Chicago. Right. Wonderful representation from overseas, from the British Red Arrows, the Air Force, the Navy. Also the Army Golden Knights Parachute Display Team. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about why they were here and what their role is.
Sure. The Golden Knights is the Army's parachute demonstration team, so they do very precise, kind of high-altitude jump demonstrations, and they brought in the flag, I think, for the opening of the ceremony and kind of kicked off the events both days. They had an opportunity to tandem jump one of the Blackhawks Hall of Famers there, and, just a great start of the show, and they are on a multi-city tour to, again, accomplish the purpose of connecting the Army with America's public.
Right. I'm sure they did a great job in doing so. Before we talk about the 101st General, let's talk a little bit about your own career in the military. ROTC Commission, when you joined, did you have a plan, a career
idea? I think about this a lot. So I knew early on I wanted to serve in the military from very, very young age. Exactly what capacity, I wasn't certain. The Army had the opportunity to join at 17, so I was able to join my junior year in high school and go to basic training between my junior and senior year and serve in the Army Reserve and the Army National Guard through college. So it was, I grew up in Milwaukee. It was a great pathway, the GI Bill to college, and it's something I always wanted to do, be part of something bigger than myself and serve in the military. And I always thought that if I enjoy something, have a passion for it, and I'm fairly good at it, I'm probably on the right path. And that's been the case for the last 35 years now. So through ROTC, I was commissioned, and my first assignment was at the 101st. And that particular first assignment where you cut your teeth as a young officer really made an impression on me. And it was that point that I was committed to staying for the long term.
You mentioned backstage, General, about the Army's increased emphasis on recruitment in cities like Chicago. Mm-hmm. What might you say to members of our audience watching online or subsequently about a career in the Army following in your footsteps?
Yeah. The most rewarding aspect of a career in the military or just service in the military, one, it's the most trusted institution in the United States. The American people trust the military more than anything else. And you get to be part of, as I said earlier, something bigger than yourself. You kind of serve a purpose. You serve in the forces which protect our country and our way of life, and you're surrounded by folks that similarly committed themselves to doing that. And, even young soldiers, we develop them as leaders. They're, in a short period of time, they're put in leadership positions, and we invest in their education and their training, and it's just an honor to serve. It's certainly an honor to be able to have served as long as I did, but just for the majority of the Army, they serve their 3 or 4 year term and go on to be productive, members of society, and I think to a man and woman, they're incredibly proud of their service. And you talk to veterans that are, 60, 70 years old, and they hearken back to their time in the military with great pride. So it's something I kind of always wanted to do, and I really enjoyed doing it.
Your career with the military began, as you said, in high school, and you now sit here today, two-star general, commanding general of the 101st. What took you from high school reservist to two-star general?
I had a typical path of I'm an infantry officer. I had typical infantry assignments. Very early, right when I got to the 101st, we deployed Desert Shield and Desert Storm. So combat experience early, I think, was very, very helpful. A lot of assignments and a lot of great units that you highlighted that just really worked for great mentors and leaders and kind of thrived in those units in that environment. So,
could you speak to the role your family has played in your career?
Yeah, my family's awesome. So, like a lot of folks in the military, both my children serve. My daughter's a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, and my son is finishing his last year at West Point now, and he's going to be an infantry officer. And my wife she's an Army civilian. She is a labor and delivery nurse at the Army Hospital down there at Fort Campbell. Tremendous support from my family. I missed the kids' adolescence, 6 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they're just awesome kids that were surrounded by other Army families, and they helped themselves through all of those deployments and the tough times, and I think it made them incredibly resilient and strong, and I'm just really proud of them, and have been blessed with their support for the last 30 years.
Wow, that wonderful testimony of intergenerational service. Right. Did you come from a family in the military?
My dad was in the Navy in the early 60s he did one term of service, but really, really proud of his time in the Navy. And my mom was in the Air National Guard up in Wisconsin, so really proud of her service as well.
You touched on this a moment ago, General, when you alluded to service in Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Is there a moment in your career that you look back on now as a two-star, as a commanding general, that was a pivotal moment that helped accelerate or?
The early combat experience in Desert Storm was, very seminal. It kind of shaped how I trained and prepared soldiers for combat, which you know, we found ourselves again, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq subsequent to 2001. Probably the most pivotal experience was my time as a battalion commander in the 101st in East Baghdad in 2005, 2006. Very tough rotation, very tough tough year there, and tough conditions. And what really is illuminated when you're in conditions like that is the incredible commitment, valor, and you know, the unbelievable service for the young men and women that fill our ranks. It was you know, that was really a crucible like year for the entire organization.
Right, I'm sure. Nobody gets where you are today, or indeed any progress in a career, without a support network,
right.
Mentors in particular. Anyone that stands out in your career that you owe a particular debt of gratitude to?
Sure. Back to that year as a battalion commander, my command sergeant major, the senior non-commissioned officer for the squadron, Chris Fields, decorated multiple times for valor, two Purple Hearts, just an incredible leader that you know, had the pulse of the unit and really instilled tough standards, tough achievable standards that you know, that group of soldiers that served in that battalion, they all kind of convened when I took command in February there at Fort Campbell, a little reunion of sorts. And you know, as often happens when you get together like that, a lot of stories of that year in particular. And you know, it just reminds us of how incredibly you know, professional and competent and, you know, standard bearer our non-commissioned officer corps is. So Chris Fields and the NCOs of that battalion were really, really impressive.
Wow. Well, moving on to the division, the 101st Airborne Division, could you perhaps let our audience know at home and here in at the Museum and Library, when is the 101st first activated?
Yep. We just celebrated our 77th birthday. It was August 16th, 1942, in Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. That's where the airborne forces, at the start of World War II, you know, the Germans had airborne forces, as did the Russians. It was apparent that that form of vertical envelopment was going to be a necessary capability for the Army. So the two first airborne divisions were stood up in August of 42 at Camp Claiborne, the 82nd Airborne Division, which was, you know, that was their birthday as an airborne division, but they existed in World War I. Alvin York, famously Medal of Honor recipient from World War I, famously served in the 82nd. The 101st was a brand new unit, though. It did not exist. And our first commanding general, William Lee, in kind of the activation ceremony, said, "We have no history, but we have a rendezvous with destiny." And that's been our motto ever since. So the 101st stood up in Louisiana, and the regiments formed across the southeast United States and really captured famously in Band of Brothers is one company and one regiment that that was part of the 101st. They all kind of coalesced and then at Fort Bragg and then deployed to England and then did their final preparations for combat, and their first combat action was the jump into D-Day, into Normandy, which we celebrated the 75th anniversary of that this last June, and we had a chance to bring 101 troopers from the division to Normandy and just walk the ground where the division fought in World War II and meet some of the veterans that were there. It was an incredibly inspiring event. So the division formed for World War II. The three major campaigns were Normandy, you know, very hard-fought campaign, the jump in, and then really intense combat ensued for about 30 days. The division went back to England to refit, absorb replacements, and get ready for the next campaign, which was Market Garden. So we'll celebrate the 75th anniversary of that on September 16th, 17th, 18th, which was a bridge too far. The 101st had the first objectives in Zond, Wagel, and Nijmegen, the 82nd, the middle objectives, and then the British, of course, at Arnhem, the bridge too far. That was the bloodiest campaign for the division in World War II. So following that, and that was another about 45, 50 days of hard combat, the division refitted and was in the process of refitting in France when the final German offensive through the Ardennes happened, the Battle of the Bulge. And, you know, it was apparent that the town of Bastogne had to be held. It was an intersection of seven major highways, and with it, the German advance would have much more momentum. Without it, they would struggle to sustain their push to the west. So the 101st, knowing that, you know, troopers of the 101st and the 101st ethos, fight surrounded, fight numerically superior forces, was put into Bastogne and told to hold, and hold they did. And that's where, famously, General McAuliffe, who was commanding the division in Bastogne, the Germans had an overture of surrender, and his immediate reaction was nuts, you know, a phrase of the day, which was, you know, just this is outlandish kind of thing. And that was actually crafted as his formal response to the German commander, nuts, the American commander. And they had to ask if it was in the affirmative or negative, and they said decidedly in the negative. And the Germans couldn't believe it. You know, a lightly equipped division defending in very harsh winter conditions. They had substantially more tanks, more artillery, more troops. But the 101st fought like hell and held Bastogne. And that was the first time an entire division was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation, this blue decoration here. After World War II, the division disbanded. You know, there was a major downsizing of the Army. It came down to probably about 25-30% of its wartime peak. And the 82nd was retained as the Airborne Division, and the 101st was deactivated to be reactivated in the heart of the Cold War in 1958. And that's when Fort Campbell became our home, and the 101st stood back up there as an airborne division. You know, so continuing our legacy and history of World War II, strike from the sky like an eagle that we wear on our patch. And the division was at a high level of training, and when Vietnam began and it was clear that there was going to be significant troop requirements there, the 101st was one of the first units to deploy in 1965, and it was there until 1972. And it was in Vietnam that it really changed from an airborne, you know, troops delivered by parachute to an air mobile, is what it was called, eventually air assault division. That was the dawn of helicopter warfare and the signature tactic or operational action for the 101st and the 1st Cavalry Division were air assaults, striking points of enemy vulnerability with troops delivered by helicopter and in places where the enemy wouldn't expect them. So that was developed over Vietnam. The division came back to the States, back to Fort Campbell in the early 70s, and then really perfected air mobility and air assault operations, and that was put to test in Desert Storm in 1990 and 91. And then continued refinement of that and really put to test again in the early days of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where we conducted multiple large-scale air assaults to continue striking, you know, the Iraqi army and the Taliban in places where they didn't think you could get significant amount of infantry in a short period of time.
Well, General, for a division that began with no history,
right,
but as befitting a history major, that's a remarkable synopsis of the history of your unit. Very impressive indeed. What can you tell us about the 101st today?
Yeah. So today we're organized around three brigade combat teams. So each of those have about 5,000 soldiers, three infantry battalions, a reconnaissance squadron, artillery battalion, all the things you'd need to fight. And then we have a combat aviation brigade that delivers them via air assault. We have a sustainment brigade that does all our major maintenance and movement of significant supplies and things of that nature. And then the division headquarters. So all told, it's about 19,000 soldiers. And we're all at Fort Campbell. Now, really, ever since 2001, we've had elements of the division deployed almost continuously. So as we speak, we have our 1st Brigade combat team in Iraq and Syria. Our 2nd Brigade is conducting a number of missions and mission support across Africa, as well as in the Ukraine, training Ukrainian military forces. Our 3rd Brigade is kind of our contingency response unit right now. They're at Fort Campbell, ready for any contingency or crisis that may require it. And our Aviation Brigade just returned from Afghanistan, and they're, you know, supporting our training, and they'll deploy to Europe next year. So the sun never sets on the Screaming Eagles. We're pretty much on, you know, about 4 different continents right now, serving the combatant commanders across the globe.
Is there a typical day for a Screaming Eagle soldier?
Sure. While they're at Fort Campbell, you know, they're generally either in a training cycle or a mission support cycle. For those that are in a training cycle, we start every single day. You know, we salute the flag when we play reveille and raise the flag at 06:30, and then we do physical training for about an hour and a half. Soldiers will eat chow, and then during the course of the day, any number of things. They may do some proficiencies with their weapons, go out to the range and shoot their weapons or the heavy weapons organic to that unit. They may conduct training on their fundamental tasks and drills. They may do some medical training or any kind of task related to what they'd be expected to do in combat. You know, when they, you know, kind of matriculate through individual proficiencies, we'll do collective live fires. So we'll rehearse, you know, a company size formation, which would be about 125 soldiers, you know, assault of a fortified position or trench clearing or any of the type of tasks that they'd execute in a contingency. And then ultimately, about once a year, we send the brigades to one of our premier training centers, one of which is in Louisiana, one of which is out in California. We mainly use the one in Louisiana, and it's a large area with a great replicated environment, you know, mock villages, dedicated role players, wow, that dedicated opposing forces, mm-hmm, dedicated role players that play civilians on the battlefield or, you know, partner nation security forces. They have, you know, armored vehicles, you know, opposing force helicopters, really, really well-resourced training event that we run the brigades through about once every, you know, 14, 16 months or so.
Wow, pretty comprehensive stuff. What would you say, General, what are the qualities that make an ideal airborne soldier?
So, you know, you want a lot of initiative. They've already demonstrated commitment by, you know, volunteering to serve in the Army. You know, commitment to the unit. You know, they got to have ironclad integrity. You know, they got to be trusted. They got to be, you know, always contributing and someone that can be counted on. Someone that'll kind of understand what has to be accomplished. So in the absence of very specific orders, he or she knows what to do and moves out and, you know, accomplishes the purpose of whatever it is that that we're doing without having to receive constant detailed instructions. So good initiative and you know, those types of traits are what we're looking for.
Have you seen over the course of your service with this division, have you seen interest in this division always remain at a high? I would have thought with the visibility historically and also in current operations, it's something that young people would want to serve in.
That's absolutely right. You know, it's a very relatively young division. You know, the 1st Infantry Division, as an example. Yes. I mean, all those predate World War I. Relatively young division, but the uniqueness of the mission and even though our book of history is relatively thin, the chapters are filled with, you know, just stories of courageousness, grit, tough soldiers that are always accustomed to fighting outnumbered and prevailing, that are always accustomed to being in the toughest of circumstances and thriving in those conditions. You know, we stand on the shoulders of our veterans. You know, this year especially, we celebrate the 75th anniversary of World War II. And as I said, we brought a contingent to Normandy, and we had a bunch of veterans at Fort Campbell for Memorial Day. We kind of have a celebration and an honor of the fallen, and had a number of veterans there from World War II. And we stand on their shoulders, and as well as the Vietnam veterans. This is the 50th anniversary. 1969, post-Tet, this is the 50th anniversary of one of the major battles for the 101st, also chronicled in a book and movie, Hamburger Hill. Is a major, Dong At Bia Mountain in the Aisha Valley. You know, there's a large North Vietnamese strong point on there, and the 101st was told to take the hill, and they fought over it in May of 1969, and we just had a sizable group of those veterans, about 150 or so, come to Fort Campbell just to link back up with each other. And these guys were largely draftees. They served in the Army maybe 2 years, and now they're about 75 years old. And here they are, after only being in the Army 18 months, 2 years, maybe drafted, training, Vietnam. If they didn't get wounded, they served a year, came back, and they were mustered out and lived their lives you know, were great members of society and all of that. And here they are, linking back up with their buddies from 50 years ago that they maybe spent, you know, less than a year in Vietnam with. And they went to Vietnam, actually, after they met at Fort Campbell and walked Hamburger Hill, and did so with some of the North Vietnamese defenders.
Did they really?
Yeah, and they brought some of the soldiers that are serving in their positions today. One gentleman, you know, he was the radio operator for Charlie Company, 3187. He brought that soldier that does that now with him to show him where he fought in Vietnam. And back to World War II in Normandy, I have to share an inspiring story. The town of Carentan was a major crossroads town in between Utah and Omaha Beach. It had to be captured. It was central to the Germans' line of communication to reinforce either beach, and it was central to the push inland from Utah Beach, especially the 4th Division. So Robert Cole was our first Medal of Honor recipient. He was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions assaulting a significant German strong point there in Carentan. He was in the 502nd Infantry Regiment. And we had a guy named Dan McBride, who was a private in that unit, who survived the war. And, you know, he came to the 75th, and I think he's 96 years old. And he was describing the assault, and they came through a causeway. Everything around it was flooded, so they had to come right up this relatively narrow road through withering fire. I mean, just the enemy was zeroed in on that approach. They knew that's where anybody assaulting the town would have to come from. So he's describing it, and he shows us where he got wounded the first time, and then he patched himself up, and then he was describing, as we're looking at the causeway and a bridge, where he assaulted the bridge and then onto the German strong point, wounded a second time. You know, just significant, harrowing, you know, close combat situation. And you could see as he was recounting the story, the memories were just coming back and back. And he got emotional and he had a tear in his eye and he said, you know, the 101st was a damn good outfit, and the best thing that happened to me in my life was being a part of it, you know.
Did
he
really?
A 96-year-old life, the best thing that happened to him in his life was being part of this division, wearing this patch and serving in the 101st.
Wow, that's impressive stuff.
Dan McBride, great guy.
Obviously, a lot of anniversaries, Overlord, Market Garden, and of course the fighting in the Bulge. For the benefits of our audience here and online, tell us a little bit about what the objectives were of the 101st in Overlord, during Overlord.
Sure. You know, all the airborne objectives, by their nature, are going to be generally seizing key crossroad towns or seizing key objectives that will eventually, you know, link up with the ground forces. So in the case of Normandy, for the 82nd, their main objective was the town of Saint-Mère-Église, another crossroad town that that controlled the highways that crossed the Merdaret River. The 101st had the town of Carentan as its main objective, as well as some crossings of the Merdaret River a little bit inland. And then ultimately, they cleared the Côte d'Ivoire Peninsula all the way up to Cherbourg. So the purpose was, one, to seize those key crossroad towns, those key lines of communication, to deny their use by the Nazis, and then to eventually have for our use as we push forces inland, and then to make the enemy fight in a bunch of different directions that, you know, just generally create a confusing situation, have them fighting throughout the depths of his formation so he couldn't just concentrate all his artillery, all his combat power, to try to thwart the beach assault. So very audacious, you know, very high risk operation. President Eisenhower had, you know, as you'd expect, he had significant concerns, and you've probably seen kind of his contingency letter.
Yes.
He had especially grave concern about the airborne operation. You know, he knew there were some casualty estimates that would have, you know, that very significant. So the night before June 5th, he went to one of the departure airfields. He wanted to kind of talk to some troops, and he selected the 101st and again the 502nd Infantry. There's a very famous picture of him talking a chalk of paratroopers, and the lieutenant is a guy named Walt Strobel, who survived the war. And President Eisenhower, and I got this account from his granddaughter, Susan Eisenhower, who was at the anniversary as well. He was so inspired by how confident these young troops were, and how you know, prepared they were, and how they were really, you know, and the drop was delayed 24 hours. They were really, you know, no more weather holds. Let's do this. And you know, the Supreme Allied Commander left very confident, to the point where that famous photo of him talking to that chalk of paratroopers, he's kind of doing this, and you think he's telling them, okay, I want you to go in there and accomplish your objective. He's actually talking about fly fishing. You know, he was so confident and so at ease that he ended up talking about fishing with some of these troops that were about to embark in C-47s en route to Normandy.
I think one of the striking things about, I guess, the airborne ethos and the training that is demonstrated in Overlord is that these guys drop scattered across the Côte d'Ivoire Peninsula, but link up with whomever they can find and push on and cause trouble wherever they can.
Yep.
And individual leadership, whatever the rank, these guys knew the mission,
that's right,
went out and did it no matter what the circumstance.
That's right.
Which is astonishing.
Yep, that's the ethos we sustain today. You know, soldiers need to understand the broad purpose of what it is we're trying to accomplish, and in the absence of specific orders, or if they find themselves in a situation that's completely unexpected or completely different, they fundamentally know what needs to be done. And just as those troops did the night of June 5th, morning of June 6th. They knew where they had to link up with their units. They knew what their objectives were, and they moved to it. And it was a tremendous enhancing operation. And you know, most of it was just inside of Utah Beach. And when you compare Utah Beach to Omaha, the casualties substantially less in Utah. And a big part of it was what the airborne forces did inland and in tying up the Germans and just creating havoc and causing confusion and things like that.
Any traditions that originate in that time period, General, that persist to this day?
Yeah, I think you know the ethos, and we're a part of 18th Airborne Corps, and though we're air assault now, we're delivered by helicopters. That tradition of you know, again, as we picked the icon for our patch, Old Abe, which was the mascot of the 8th Wisconsin in the Civil War. You know, like an eagle, we strike from the sky, where our prey is totally not expecting it. So that still is how we operate. You know, we air assault forces and points of enemy vulnerability and do it at a tempo that he just can't react to, as was the case in World War II. And then that fundamental ethos and spirit of the airborne and air assault trooper that you highlighted. You know, they understand what needs to happen. They exercise disciplined initiative. They know what needs to be accomplished, and you don't have to prod them or push them. It's oftentimes you have to rein them back a little bit, and that's exactly what you want. You know, aggressive soldiers know what to do.
Any traditions that were a part of the airborne that are no longer, that you would lament the passing of, perhaps?
You know, I some of the traditions that prevail, you know, airborne and air assault troopers wear the brown jump boots with our service uniform, which is unique to airborne and air assault and Ranger units. We wear the distinct glider patch on our headgear that's directly from World War II, and that's the old Waco glider and the parachute, which kind of illustrates how airborne forces were delivered to the battlefield then, and we wear that today. We really relish our history. It's a special point of pride for units like the 101st and the 82nd, where soldiers really understand, and appreciate and learn from and draw energy from those who have gone for us and written those earlier chapters in our book of history. Some of the airborne forces and the scale of airborne operations subsequent to World War II is much smaller. There was a few combat jumps in Korea, one jump in Vietnam, and then combat jumps were in the early phases of both Afghanistan and Iraq, but much smaller scale than something like Market Garden or Normandy.
While we're on that topic, General, to the extent that you have a crystal ball, large-scale airborne operations like Market Garden or Overlord, are they gone for good from the battlefield?
No, I don't think so. It's certainly a capability that if you want to employ. You know, you want to deploy forces strategic distances, but have operational significance. That's a way to do a joint forcible entry, where if you're in an environment where you can't land troops or you can't get there over ground, airborne and air assault is certainly an arrow we want in the defense quiver of the joint force of the United States. And it's really played out in every major conflict. There's, you know, and even today, air assault operations are central to what we're doing in Afghanistan and, to a lesser extent, Iraq.
You obviously have a tremendous grasp of the history of the unit and how it fits into the history of the United States Army. What does the division do to inculcate, formally, I suppose, in the minds of your soldiers, that proud history?
Yeah. It's a natural line of drift with the 101st. You know, we expect soldiers to immerse themselves in their profession and, read like Stephen Ambrose books and Band of Brothers, especially A Bridge Too Far, you know, kind of understand the campaigns. The Command Sergeant Major Barker and I talk to every group of new soldiers that come to the division, about a weekly basis. We'll have a tranche of 150 or so soldiers joining us, and we kind of talk through the division history and then share stories like I did with Dan McBride, or stories of our Medal of Honor recipients, and stories of, again, our veterans and the incredible legacy they uh, they've lent us. And then we have each year Week of the Eagles, which is the week before Memorial Day, and a lot of veterans converge at Fort Campbell just to kind of see their old outfits, and we do a division review, a division run, a bunch of sporting events, you know, to kind of enhance camaraderie and, you know, just friendly competition, and it turns into a reunion of sorts for a lot of the veterans, and it's great having soldiers, that Vietnam group that I talked about. You know, they did a long road march in their honor, and then linked up and had like a picnic with them, and just seeing kids today, young soldiers today, talking to someone who was in their shoes 50 years early and earlier, and hearing their stories of again valor and courageousness and their pride in the unit, it just instills that. And it's contagious, and it's easy to keep going.
I'm sure, tremendous. So, General, after 31 years plus years in uniform, what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning still?
Yeah, I just being able to serve, and being able to serve in a special unit like the 101st, and being surrounded by soldiers who likewise have a lot of pride in what they do and the unit that they serve in. Keeps you young, keeps you motivated. Doing PT with them in the morning, it just keeps you going.
When was the last time you did a parachute drop?
A parachute when I was in the 82nd, so probably about 3 years ago. And my son went to jump school right as I was leaving there as well, so I had a chance to pin my original jump wings from 1986 on him.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So looking back at that career, proudest achievements?
Yeah, I think, again, I'll always hearken back to that battalion command tour in Iraq. Very proud of how the unit accomplished some really tough missions in very challenging circumstances. And, the soldiers just were courageous. They took care of each other. They knew what to do. And, it sustained us for what was a really tough year-plus rotation there. So that particular unit, getting it ready for combat and fighting with it in Iraq, and the connections that we still maintain, just 150 or so of the 500 original members still converge and meet here at Fort Campbell and have reunions and things like that. It's just a great special group of folks that I'll have a perpetual friendship till the day I die.
Very, very impressive. One question that struck me as we're sitting here and thinking about World War II and Normandy, I think Winston Churchill once commented that the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without allies. Any thoughts on interoperability and allied nations you've served alongside that come to mind?
Sure. Of course, everything we're doing in Africa, the Ukraine, and of course Iraq and Syria right now is hand in glove with our allied partner nations that are part of those operations. So in the case of Afghanistan, virtually all the NATO partners have a contribution. So we're conducting operations, and the command itself, there's key staff officers and commanders from our partner nations just woven into it. When I was the DCG of the 82nd, my fellow DCG was a British one-star, a guy named Giles Hill, who's still serving in the British Army. And we did a number of operations, in support of EUCOM and with our NATO partners. One that jumps to mind was an airborne assault in the three countries, Romania, Germany, and Bulgaria, in aircraft that were from six different countries and paratroopers from eight different NATO countries, conducting three significant drops in the same day, near simultaneously. So that is very much a priority. There's obvious priority to our NATO partners and our partners that we're fighting with in Iraq and other named operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other named contingencies. And it's a challenge. You've got to make sure all the communication equipment's interoperable, that we have kind of standard understanding of operational terms and graphics, and have good liaison detachments with each other. It's woven into virtually every major exercise that we do. We'll have some international partner.
Right. Interesting stuff. From your vantage point, General, and over this long and storied career, any particular characteristics of leadership that obviously you exhibit, but which have stood you in good stead that you would encourage young leaders to think about?
Yep. Yeah, for young leader, you know, young NCOs, young officers, you know, there's a few leader attributes that are really important. One, they have to have sterling character. You know, they have to be absolutely trusted. They have to have perfect integrity. You know, the other traits are just fundamental technical and tactical proficiency. They need to understand their trade. You know, if they're a infantry platoon leader, they need to understand the tactics and operational actions that an infantry platoon would do. They need to understand all the communication equipment and the weapons in that unit. They need to know how to summon resources from outside of that organization, like artillery support and attack aviation support. And they need to be very competent and competent in all of those types of proficiencies. The Army is a very physically challenging endeavor. The rigors of combat are very physically challenging, so we put a very high premium on physical fitness. Leaders at all echelons need to be very fit, very resilient, and they need to lead from the front and by personal example in everything that they do. The other fundamental values of just exhibit selfless service, integrity that I'd mentioned, personal courage, exhibiting not being afraid of something, but putting those fears aside and leading your unit through something that you may have apprehension about is personal courage. Those types of characteristics and values are inculcated in all of our professional education for leaders. For officers, it's woven into their pre-commissioning experience, whether that's ROTC or the Service Academy. And it's something that we emphasize and have constant dialogue and development sessions on to make sure that leaders have those fundamental traits.
Here at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, we are a library, any particular works of military history that you have read that you have felt as though they have, well, inspired you, but contributed to your development as a professional development as a general officer?
Yep. I really loved Stephen Ambrose, so I've read all of his works, and obviously he had the focus on Easy Company 506 with the Band of Brothers, but all his accounts from his book on Lewis and Clark, Undaunted Courage, to all his chronicles of World War II, I really find those interesting. Also, some of the other books that that really made an impact on me, one was This Kind of War by T.R. Fehrenbach. It talks about the Korean War, and he was a company commander in the war. It's really a study in the impacts of not being as prepared as you can be for the rigors of combat. And that was brutal, brutal combat in the Korean War. And some units just, it's a little study in the impact and consequence of not being prepared, and how the Army kind of was hollow and came down a little too small and too quickly after World War II and wasn't at the right level of readiness. But then you see it turn during the course of the Korean War, and you see the Army get much, much better, and the Army's always been a real learning organization. You saw that from Kazarin to the remainder of the European campaigns, and you saw it in the first 9 months or so of the Korean War, and then the subsequent improvement that the Army made. So This Kind of War by T.R. Fehrenbach is a really good one. I also like, and this year especially, been reading a lot of World War II accounts. So Pegasus Bridge, A Bridge Too Far, The Longest Day, those are all great. And I read one before each campaign that we get a chance to go visit to celebrate the 75th this year.
Well, it's hard to avoid those accounts, but it's great to read them again,
right,
I think.
Yeah.
So one sort of final question before we open up to the audience for questions. You commented then about the Army being drawn down pretty swiftly and to a much smaller scale after World War II. Mm-hmm. Same thing happened to the U.S. Army after World War I. Looking ahead from your vantage point again to the future, what is the future for the United States Army? Is that unpreparedness, I would like to think it's no longer on the agenda, but looking ahead, what are the big challenges for the Army?
Sure. We've had good budgets here for the last 3 years or so. So when you look to 2012, the budget uncertainty with sequestration and the sharp reduction had the Army coming down to a pretty low level. That's tapered out. We kind of arrested that decline, and the Army is moving towards The Army's about 1,018,000 in all three components. Active components about just short of 500,000, and then the remainder are in the Army Guard and Army Reserve. Readiness has been General Milley's priority since he's been the Chief of Staff for the last 4 years. And that's readiness for a high-end threat. So the Army is, understandably, was really focused on what we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, from the 2001 to, 2010, 11, 12 timeframe, as you'd expect and understandably so. But it was recognized that there was probably an atrophy in our high-end warfighting capabilities. So General Milley really emphasized reattaining readiness to fight low probability but high consequence scenarios like Korea, like Eastern Europe, against a threat that has significant numbers of sophisticated weapons, et cetera. So we've really focused on that and have been doing some high-end training, especially with our combined arms units, our armor brigades, keeping them out of the rotation pool for the coin fight in Iraq and Afghanistan and keep them trained and honed for a high-end warfighting competencies. And then we rotate them to Korea or Europe where they're able to kind of build on that. So readiness has been the top priority. It remains top priority. But for long-term readiness, the current acting Secretary of the Army, Ryan McCarthy, who's from Chicago, by the way, he is very focused. And Secretary Esper, now the SecDef, was the Sec Army, along with General Milley and General McConville. General Milley is going to be the chairman, McConville's our chief of staff now. A longer look at readiness is modernizing the Army. It's time to really develop what the next M1 main battle tank is going to be, the Bradley fighting vehicle, the Black Hawk, the Apache helicopters, the Patriot air defense system. So they are very focused on six modernization priorities in long-range fires and air and missile defense and the next generation combat vehicle and future vertical lift and soldier lethality things, what the next small arms weapons are going to be, and then the network, how we're going to communicate and network all of our systems and soldiers. So a lot of investment, and we stood up the Army Futures Command. That's a four-star command down in Texas that's looking at all of those problems. And by about 2028, in the not too distant future, we're going to see the next generation of all of those major systems here, and that's going to ensure long-term readiness. So that, coupled with high-end training, is going to attain what we all want, a kind of a peace through strength. The Army and the Joint Force will be so capable that no one would dare miscalculate and try to fight the U.S. militarily.
General, I think that is a very reassuring note for us to end on. Thank you very much for your time today. We're going to open it up to questions from the floor.
Great. Sir.
Are there females in the 101st? And if so, how do they work out?
They work out great. About 20% of the Army is female. In the 101st, it's right around 15-18% of our formations, female soldiers. They're in every military occupational specialty. We've had female soldiers graduate the U.S. Army Ranger School. There are females in the Special Forces pipeline, training pipeline now, and they're serving very successfully in every single unit that we have in the 101st and across the Army. As I mentioned earlier, my daughter is a Black Hawk helicopter pilot, and she's thriving in the military like so many thousands of other female soldiers. So this is, it's relatively new. The MOS is open to all MOSs, military occupational specialties, open to females. It's really only been going for a couple of years, so we're in the nascent stage of it. But it's becoming routine where there's females as part of every subordinate element in the 101st and across the Army. Yeah. They're great. It's making the Army stronger. It really is. Sir.
Thank you for coming here, General. Could you give us a prognosis on the new SFABs? I think it's Security Force Assistance Brigades.
Sure. We're going to build five of them in the active Army and one in the Army Guard. It's essentially going to, as the name implies, it's a purpose-built organization that does security force assistance. So it's relatively small, about 1,500 soldiers, where a brigade combat team's about 5,000. But it's very leader-heavy, and all of the leaders, so a battalion commander or command sergeant major in the SFAB was already a successful battalion commander or command sergeant major, and now they're going to train partner nation security forces on those fundamental competencies. So the idea behind them are, instead of, like right now, we have our first brigade in Iraq and Syria training, advising the Iraqi security forces there and the vetted Syrian opposition forces in the case of Syria. We could have these advisor brigades do that and then not break apart that brigade combat team to do that. They could stay focused on those high-end competencies of large-scale air assaults and things of that nature. And then the other thought is, if we have five of these things and one in the Guard, it could be the skeleton of a brigade combat team if we have to really rapidly expand the Army for a national contingency or a big contingency like, facing the Russian threat or Korea. We could add, a couple thousand soldiers to this SFAB, which is really the leadership structure of a brigade, and get them up and running and operating as a brigade combat team in pretty short order.
What is your reenlistment retention rate among enlisted people and among officers in the last, say, two or three years?
Yeah, retention has been great. Recruiting has been a challenge. So we're meeting our goals for retaining folks, for soldiers, non-commissioned officers, and warrant officers, which are mainly our helicopter pilots. I'll talk about that in a second, and officers. So retention has been good. Recruiting has been a challenge. The Army's gotten small, and you talk about Chicago or Illinois here. The Army Reserve and Army Guard is certainly present here in Illinois, and then you got recruiters and whatnot. But there's no major Army base near the major metro area of Chicago, and that's a big part of why we're up here this weekend. We brought a couple helicopters up and about 30 soldiers. About six or seven of which are from Chicago, just to connect Chicago with Chicago's Army, the U.S. Army, and connect soldiers with civilians they serve, and just talk about the Army. I think just to know us, and that's why we have this phenomenon where a lot of military kids end up joining the military themselves. I think it's because they see how incredible the Army is, and they connect with the values that we. That we share and things like that. So retention, to your question, good. Recruiting, we need some work. And we're really focusing on major metro areas like Chicago, Philly, New York, which are pretty underrepresented in the ranks right now, too. So, again, we want, there's a big pool here, and we want to connect kids in Chicago with the military. And if it's a good fit for them, to have them join our ranks.
I like the new uniform. Yeah. The military, the Army in specific, has always, to me, been the one part of our government that is still connected to the revolutionary fervor. It is always led when our society sometimes is behind. For example, it integrated when we had segregation. Right. It led in women when we were arguing about whether women could handle that kind of thing. Gays and lesbians, always the military was the revolutionary force that moved society ahead. And it seems to me right now we're going through a kind of revolution. I don't think the American people want to pay to defend the world anymore. I'm not sure when I see Boris Johnson in England or the head of Italy or riots going on every day in France. It seems to me that the idea of the liberal order going into a country to regime change and change the country to be more like us probably died in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think it's going to be the future. What do you see as the future?
Yeah, so again, kind of what I was talking about with modernization. We want a military that's so capable that we don't have to use it. That is the fundamental of peace through strength. Nobody hates war more than those who fight it. And those in the military want a strong military to have that deterrent effect, to where we would never find ourselves in a situation where someone miscalculates and thinks there's weakness and makes a strategic military move that can't be balanced or countered. So looking to the future, you know, obviously my time in the Army's, you know, I'm much closer to the end than I am to the beginning. But, for the generations that follow, we want them to have the best possible equipment, be organized in the best possible way, have world-class, best possible training. So they're at a state where the world knows that you cannot take on the U.S. Army and hope to have any degree of success whatsoever. With regard to your earlier discussion about things that the military has led society on, that's something we're incredibly proud of. And it is, the uniqueness of the U.S. military is we all take an oath to the Constitution, and we're part of the executive branch, so everything in Article 2 of the Constitution spells out the conditions of civilian control of the military and how the military is structured and our authorities, to where you would never, ever, ever worry in the United States about the military being involved in political things. You could never fathom a change of government in the United States that the military would intervene or disrupt, which is not the case in a lot of countries across the globe. With regard to, you mentioned the racial integration in the late 1940s there after World War II and before Korea. You just think about soldiers. Think about soldiers from Chicago. You know Olive Park as you go out on Navy Pier? Everybody know what I'm talking about? This is the park going out on Navy Pier. It's named after Milton Olive, a young African-American kid that grew up here in Chicago, joined the Army and was a paratrooper in the 173rd Airborne Brigade. And in Vietnam in the early years, he's in a platoon of folks from all across the country, every racial and religious background. And during the course of a firefight, an enemy grenade came into their position, and he jumped on it and smothered it and saved all those fellow soldiers from all over the country, from every different kind of background you can imagine. I mean, that's what happens when somebody's in the military and they form that brotherhood, that sisterhood with those they serve with. Race, religion is irrelevant. They serve to take care of each other, to help each other through tough circumstances, just as Milton Olive did in 1965 and just as kids do this very day. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Please.
Final question.
I think it was Eisenhower that said planning is more important than the plan. What did you learn about planning and leadership, particularly in a tough time like Iraq, for example?
Yeah. I think, when you really, and we plan. I mean, we plan like crazy in the military. And what it does is it starts to eliminate ambiguity. The plan, as kind of General Eisenhower said, the plan is nothing, but planning is everything. It generates contingencies, so when it doesn't go according to plan, the branches or the contingencies are thought through, and everybody fundamentally knows what everybody else is doing, so you can operate with disciplined initiative. So when the conditions are different, the basic purpose, as was the case with 101st Troopers in Normandy and Market Garden and Bastogne. They knew the broad purpose, and that's really all they needed. But all that detailed planning, the Army's big, and just to sustain the Army, and the Army does a lot of the sustainment for the joint force. So just feeding and moving and maintaining, hundreds of thousands of troops and stuff, there's just a lot of detailed hard work planning that goes into all of that. And sometimes, they make it look easy, but it's a lot of tough staff work that's largely unheralded, but really, really important.
General, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you to Major General Brian Winsky for a great discussion. And thank you to the generous members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago.
explore original exhibits on military history, or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.